welcome back to a brand new episode of the Armchair Ref podcast. We are delighted to announce that this episode is sponsored by... No, I'm just kidding. We're not that big just yet. So if anybody does want to come and sponsor us, then the door is open. But how are we feeling, Ben? How are we going?
I think as an England fan, I'm probably not feeling too great. I'm not to get straight into it, but probably disappointed is the word I'm going to use. But yeah, as a general person, I'm all right.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, you know, for our viewers and our listeners, and like, you can give yourself a little title when you come into the studio, and Ben's is disappointed English. So I'm getting the impression you're not feeling too hot. You're not feeling, you know, passionate or particularly happy with how the weekend went.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it, but I'm impressed with your Forza Italia, like strong Italian. It's beautiful. And how disappointing was that game?
Oh, yeah. We'll dive deeper into it later, but I just think this Six Nations is proving to be way more open-ended. Well, besides Ireland, I just think it's providing storylines that I wasn't expecting. And to go further than that, it just means that season two of Full Contact is just going to be incredible.
It is going to be spicy, yeah.
But that now begs the question, are the NFL scriptwriters, are they now like, oh, did I say NRL?
You did say NFL, you were all good.
Oh, did I say, yeah, well, maybe the scriptwriters for the NFL have now crept their way into it. No, I'm kidding. But what if Netflix is, you know, pushing money behind the doors because maybe they heard that the storylines in season one wasn't particularly gripping and now they thought, okay, we need to up the ante.
Yeah, maybe. And I'm sure France were like, yeah, we'll take the money and flop. Like...
yeah, no, fair enough. Fair enough. But it was a really good weekend of rugby. We love it when international rugby plays. So let's get straight into it. There's plenty to discuss. Let's start with the France-Italy. Let's work our way backwards through the weekend. I mean, Forza Italia. I mean, I think that has to be said to start off.
Yeah, unbelievable. Oh, I was so hyped for them. And I actually had money on them to win the game.
Did you?
Yeah, I don't know if I sent you a screenshot or not, but I was just feeling it after we spoke last week. So I was getting pretty excited in the second half.
Yeah, you had a lot more riding on the game than most people.
I think I only had like £5 on it. But then like, when the red card came up, I was like, this is it. It's coming.
Oh, my word. So was it a parlay? Did you have other things riding on it? Or was it just like a one-off bet?
It was just a one-off bet, which is quite lucky. So
okay, right. Okay, that makes it even more intense, you know, that you almost cashed in.
Yeah, exactly. But it shows gambling's a mug's game.
Yeah, but I'm sure if you actually cashed out, and you wouldn't be saying that on the podcast this week.
I could have cashed out for so much money. I put £5 on, like before he kicked at the end, I could have cashed out for like £100.
Oh my word. How much would you have won if he went over?
Like £200. So I was like, I'm backing him. Yeah, turns out it was a windy day and the ball fell off.
A windy day in an indoor stadium.
Yeah, yeah. It was unbelievable. I've never seen so many
fans. Must be blowing really hard. Oh, man. I can't believe it. I mean, we were just having this chat, my housemate and I, about the history. So Italy have only beaten France like 3 times in their own existence. Twice in the Six Nations, and that was like 2011 and 2013. So over a decade ago, like that's a lot of defeat.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Italy have put the L in Italy quite a lot.
Yes.
There's a reason there's no W in Italy. but yeah, I was really rooting for him. I think the thing that stands out for me from that game is in that first half, how good their defense was. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the resounding thing, because they were just getting battered. And the defense held so strong. Like, they went into halftime down on points, but it could have been way worse. So then when, you know, Dante's, and I think it was a red card. I don't think there's much to query about. But when that came up red, it was like, well, surely they can do it now.
Yeah.
What did you think, Mike? Were you holding faithful, or did you not think it was going to happen?
I'll be honest. I had four Frenchmen in my fantasy team, and my captain was also also French. So I was kind of hoping that it was going to be a beating, and I predicted it to be so. But it, in a weird way, I'm happy to be proven wrong. Like, I'm glad that Italy, you know, gave the performance they did. I think I want to quickly speak on that red card from Dante. Like, watching it is as clear as a red card as you can, as you could want. You know, from a world rugby point of view, that is the type of tackle that they're trying to eradicate from the game.
Yeah.
There was no mitigation. Everybody knew that. Yet the ref still went with a yellow and went a bunker review. In my opinion, I think I have mentioned this in previous episodes, I'd rather him just have the confidence to be like, that is a red card, I don't need it to be questioned, and then, you know, no need for the TMO. Oh, sorry, no need for the bunker, because then it's separate. And I think having that confidence and authority to, you know, make that final decision actually creates a bit more respect for the referee going forward. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the review system in general. I think it makes so much sense. Why get some guy standing like 50 meters away from a big screen to make a decision when someone can have all the angles and have time to do it? But as you were saying, it was kind of clear as day. That was never coming back as a yellow. As soon as we saw it was like, he's done. It would have been nice to just see that red card come out, but I don't know what the referee's instructions are. I don't know if World Rugby are saying, if in doubt, just send it. Or, well, in fact, there was no doubt. Or if they're saying, if it's a red, just send it and let someone else decide.
Yeah, I think that just undercuts the referees a little bit. And there's just too many cooks in the kitchen. Let the ref cook, you know? Anyway, I think it looked very promising for France. You know, they scored pretty quickly, you know, under 10 minutes. They were 13-0 up, I think, within 15 minutes. You know, they went 65 minutes without scoring a further point. So I don't know what's happened to this French team. My honest opinion is that I think they're in a grieving period. They're seeing DuPont, you know, do bits on the Sevens circuit. They're seeing him score tries for the, you know, for the Sevens team. But I think that they're almost trying to find their identity again post DuPont. And I mentioned, you know, last week how there are other players that, you know, like Ontemac, that, you know, provides the cohesiveness for that team. And it's not all just about DuPont. But because DuPont was literally the centerpiece of that team and everything ran through him for so long, that now he's gone, they've got to find their footing again. And they just, yeah, I just think they're going through growing phases. I feel like they're rebuilding almost because their structure has just been thrown completely off.
Yeah, I think DuPont is a factor, but I think it's like overhyped. Do you know what I mean? Like, Luku and also like Le Garrick, both of them are pretty decent nines. And I think it's like an easy scapegoat almost for the French team and like for everyone. But the more I like read, the more I hear that like Gauthier is not a great manager, like not good with people, which is why like Ibanez was in there as well. And now Ibanez is gone. I wonder if he's winding people up as well, because he took a lot of flack after the World Cup. And whether he's just like winding the players up and not creating a good atmosphere, because, yeah, I can imagine that would have a massive impact. You hear about some of these managers who come in, create like a good, positive environment and things kind of take off. And so if that's true, I'm guessing the other way must be true as well. Someone's creating bad vibes.
Yeah. At what point do you think Gaultier is in the hot seat? you know, for his managerial position. Like, you know, they've had a failure at the World Cup. Yes, it was close, but, you know, they are on track now. They should be 0-3. There is an argument for them to be 0-3 at this point in the Six Nations. So when do they start to question him?
I think, and this is based on nothing, this is a wild statement. I think if they lose one more game in the Six Nations, he's gone.
Okay, because they've still got to play England and...
Wales. And they should both of these teams. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think if they lose one of them, there's a pretty strong argument.
Yeah. And I reckon they'll lose both.
Yank.
Well, you hope. I hope from an England case, but like Wales, I feel like Wales just aren't that far off either.
I don't know. I think the thing is, I also think that they're in a really tough position where they're also like going through a lot of injuries as well. So like Jalibert, you know, he's just got his ankle in out for like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
You've now got Dante banned for 5 weeks. Aldrete, you know, he's injured. Jalonch injured, you know. So it's not like he's got the best players available to him, you know, at his disposal to kind of get the results he wants. But in saying that, he does have a squad good enough to do a better job than they are currently.
Yeah, that's what I think. I don't really think he's got any excuses there. The excuses I like to throw around when England play bad, but realistically, they don't fly. Like, when England play bad, like, they should be better.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same for France. Like, they've got the depth. And, like, when you see the top 14 and those teams play in Europe and stuff, they've got the skill and the talent available. So, I don't know. I think they should be doing it.
Just on a quick side note, right? I just had this thought. Should the Six Nations be postponed to a later time in the year if it's in the same year as the Rugby World Cup?
Ooh.
And the reason why I asked that question is, you know, if you go, let's take South Africa, for example, because that's why I'm thinking of it.
Yeah.
A lot of the players that were in the final and were in that Rugby World Cup squad, they pushed their body to the limits. They were absolutely broken. Like, even Etzebeth has to have knee surgery. Jean Klein, Achir Snyman, you know, they both were, you know, out of action, not returning to their clubs. They are literally pushing, you know, their body to the absolute max and putting it all on the line. But then luckily for the Springboks, they're not playing till June, July, you know, so they've got time to kind of heal. I know that there's club rugby in the mix, you know, post World Cup, and there's contracts involved, etc. But, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, player welfare and how much game time they're getting all year round, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a real good question. I don't think the Six Nations should be moved, purely because if the Six Nations would be moved, they would just be club rugby anyway. Like, I think the amount these players are getting paid, like, relative to how much money is in the game, I don't think there's ever going to be an excuse for them not to play. What I do think is the summer tour the following year should be called off, so then they have, like, a proper full off season. For, like, Northern Hemisphere teams.
So then the Southern Hemisphere just do, like, the Rugby Championship.
Yeah. Because I think that,
okay. You
know, because it just doesn't stop. Like, as you were saying, the season's so long. But I also know that when Northern Hemispheres travel to the Southern Hemisphere, that brings a lot of money to these, like, to those nations as well. So I can't imagine anyone's going to be too keen to give up a few international games.
Yeah, and I do wonder whether the game at the current state can actually even afford, you know, postponing or, you know, cancelling tours like that. Mm. Anyway, it was just a little sidetrack. Are there any other more thoughts on France's performance before we just, like, touch a bit more on Italy?
I just thought that he looked just a bit lackluster after that first, you know, 20 minutes. Like in the second half, yeah, they actually didn't look that bad with Ramos at 10. I actually think if he moves to 10, that would be quite good for them going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was as if they just couldn't quite finish anything. Whereas like France a year ago, they would have just finished. How about you, Mike? What do you think? What did you get from France?
Yeah, well, nothing really. 13 points worth. I don't know. I just think, I don't know if this team has the resilience yet. I think they've not got this. Yeah, I just think, you know, things were kind of falling into place and everything was coming a bit easy to them. But like now they're going through like arguably their toughest moments now. And, you know, they're not showing any massive signs of resilience. There's not been any like player performances for me that like standing out and being like, you know, absolute leaders. Like, I know I speak about Springboks a lot, but like, you know, when we were in the semi-final against England, we were down and out until like Oxenchair came on and, you know, put a performance and said, you know, I'm helping the team and digging us out of this hole. I'm not seeing any type of leadership, you know, from, you know, any performances in the French side at the moment. So I don't know. And mentioning going back to Galtier as well, you know, I'm sure he was telling them that the squad, you guys are God's gift. You guys are going to win the World Cup for the first time. You're going to win a home World Cup. Believe in my plan. And, you know, obviously it didn't work. So I wonder if there's a bit of, you know, there's a gap now between the managers and the players and whether they actually are on the same page anymore.
Yeah, I reckon make Sean Edwards head coach and then we get to hear his Northern French.
L'opportunité. Yeah. I'm not going to swear. Yeah, that was priceless. What about like Ronan O'Gara?
Oh, yeah, do you know what? That would be a pretty good hiring. Yeah.
Has he just signed a contract with La Rochelle then?
Probably, but I can't imagine.
I have a feeling he might have.
Yeah, but France rugby or like French rugby has the money. Like they could buy him out. It's not like most other sides worldwide where, you know, money is an issue. Like it's thriving in France, and hopefully this international team don't kill it off for him.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Okay, let's quickly, before we move on to the other games, Italy.
Yeah.
Where do you want to be in?
Well, what did you think, Mike? Give us your overview.
Sure, I can go. It's amazing. There's so much controversy around that final kick, you know, whether it should have been retaken, you know, because obviously for those that don't know, Garbisi, you know, the Italy managed to get a penalty and then they had a shot at goal in, you know, after the clock was red to win the game. And the France players actually started to charge down the penalty as the ball kind of like fell off the tee. And actually when he re-teed it. And in the laws, they're not allowed to do that. You've got to stand still and you've got to stand 10 meters away. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one. And my heart breaks for me. He didn't look too sad. I must say, he didn't look like he was heartbroken after he missed the kick.
Yeah, I think the pressure gets taken off when it falls off the tee. Do you know what I mean? Like, had he missed that kick without the ball falling off, I think that's a different... Like, there's expectation he hits it. But when it falls off and he's got no time, and he has to take, like, a two-step, I think it makes it a bit easier. But I know what you mean. He didn't seem gutted.
I was thinking about this. I think it was almost, I'm not saying best case scenario because, you know, they had an opportunity to win and write history, but they drew the game at the end of the game, at the end of the day. So if it was, you know, 13-12 and he missed that kick, then that's way worse than they were in a comfortable-ish position already with an opportunity to win rather than I need this to not lose again.
Yeah, I hear you. I know what you mean.
So, you know, that point could come be very crucial come the wooden spoon race, you know, between them and Wales. So, yeah, I don't know. I think they have had massive improvements. We cast our minds back to a year ago. That same fixture, the score was 60-7. So it's a 53-point difference, and now there is a 0-point difference. Lots of factors. And like I mentioned last week, I was really surprised. There's still some really crucial injuries in that Italian squad, and they managed to pull that off. Away from home as well. Oh, yeah, very, very impressive.
Yeah. I'm actually going to take a different stance to you. Whereas you're gassing them up, I'm actually feel different.
Okay.
Obviously, I'm happy. Obviously, I'm happy. But realistically, as we've said before, with when we were talking about Scotland, France, like they shouldn't have been in a position at the end of that game to not win it. Like they should have put that away. And I think Italy are actually better than that. I think the draw is great because they've not done well, but I actually think they should have won. And I'm actually a bit gutted that they didn't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all are. I think everybody that wasn't French was probably rooting for Italy to win.
Yeah. And they've been like the nearly people for so long, right? It's like, oh, they nearly, they just need to put everything together. And I actually don't think they fully put everything together in this game either.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm becoming a bit disappointed, and I actually didn't. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they need to do something. They need to win a game.
They do. They really do. I agree with you, but I think this game is more monumental than all the other near misses. I would still personally put France in a class above the rest. You know, going into this fixture now, I mean, that's shifting up to me. But so to give that performance away from home against this French side, which, you know, was still star-studded, I think that is massive steps in the right direction, more so than what we've seen in the past, like against England and against Ireland. Like, I think this is like another level.
Yeah, I you're probably right. Yeah, I guess I just, with the red card, I really thought they could have and should have won.
Yes.
And I actually think, bar the play for their try, they didn't do a lot of attacking.
Okay.
And I think last year, especially in the Six Nations, or in fact the last two, their attack has actually been really good. It's almost like they've, I don't know, like they've blunted it a bit, which is probably very hard.
Okay.
But yeah, I was just kind of really hoping that they'd show a bit more of what they've... If they'd shown what they showed the last 2 years, I think they would have won that game.
Okay, I'm with you. So at the end of the day, we're both saying Forza Italia going forward in the next two weeks.
Yeah.
Like, we believe in them. We just have high expectations now.
Exactly. I'm expecting two wins out of two against Scotland.
What? Right, okay, let's move on to the next game. Let's talk Calcutta Cup.
Oh, I'll let you start.
I wonder why. Okay, I had the privilege of going to the game.
Yeah.
And much better display of rugby. Well, for me, I thought there was no pointless kicking and this stupid, you know, onside rule. It was a better display. I'm going to come out on the gates and say Scotland should count themselves very lucky. I don't think that performance should kind of, give them the confidence that things are going to go right in the future. You know, they've still got a big fixture against Ireland coming up, you know, which could, you know, in the end, you know, dictate the championship. But I just thought that Dion van der Merwe is an absolute freak. He has a special vendetta against Englishmen because, like, I don't know how he keeps scoring. I think I read a stat that he has scored like 13% of his tries against England, or it might have been a higher statistic or something. I just think for me, those tries were all individual pieces of play that were amazing. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to take anything away. But Scotland's attack, it wasn't cohesive. They didn't break England down as such and then create opportunities for themselves. Like the first Duran Vandermeer try was a beautiful set piece, and it was a poor defensive read from Henry Slade. And then the other two were, well, the second try was, you know, a mistake from England that he just capitalized on because it was just him v Ben Earl around the outside.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just think I'll let you speak more on England side, but England in the first 20 minutes looked untouchable. Like, I thought this was going to be an absolute demolishing, and Scotland had almost gone back to their let's spend the first 15 minutes waking up still and then we'll start playing rugby. But England just weren't able to convert the pressure into points. I know it's a cliche thing, but they were dominating every area of the park, but the score was like, yeah, like 7-0 or something. It should have been way higher.
Yeah, and to be fair, like on Duran Vandermeer, like what he did is what he's world class at, right? Like running with space, like no one's getting him there. Like all three of his tries, he was world class at what he did for those. But yeah, as you were saying with England, like I think all three of those came from English mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like. So I don't want to take anything away from the tries. They're ridiculous. And like Scotland winning, I said they had no bottle last week, so I'm going to have to put my hands up and say I was wrong.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to do it. But, and like especially at the, like, the second half with the scoreboard pressure, kicking the three points, like, yeah, really, really smart. But I don't think either team were particularly great. I think England dominated a few like parts of the game, got in good field, but then a lot of their attack felt like one-off runners, or when they tried some first phase moves, there were knock-ons. Like England had lost 22 turnovers. Like, how are you expecting to win a game with that? It's wild.
You know what? I want to. That reminded me of something you said about how Scotland shoot. You know, applying the scoreboard pressure and choosing the 3 points. I didn't realise that it wasn't common practice for that Scottish team to do that. And what I mean by that is that every time they chose to kick the three in the most logical places to take the three, the whole crowd went ballistic.
Yeah.
They were cheering Finn Russell every time they chose the three. And I was like looking around thinking, why? Like, you just kicked the tee. Like, I don't understand. I was just, so it seems that, you know, that is a new brand of thinking that's gone in the Scottish camp.
Yeah.
So hats off to them, I guess, for fair doing enough. The smart things. I don't know.
That's such a cold reading of it. yeah. But no, to be fair, the crowd seemed unreal. Like once they woke up, once Scotland woke up on the pitch, the crowd seemed ridiculous. But it was a very quiet first like 15 minutes.
It was. It really was. And I must say, the English supporters were nowhere near as loud to the French. The Le Crunch, you know, in my mind, is still 1-0 to France at the moment. I think also another, you know, part of those 22 turnovers, and I think a really interesting talking point is like the aerial battle. So George Furbank was chosen to start at 15. He did end up scoring a try for England. How did you feel about that selection? How did you feel about the omission of Freddie Stewart? And in terms of like putting this into context of like England's attacking display.
Yeah, I actually really liked Furbank's inclusion.
Okay.
I thought he, in general, actually looked really good. And it was nice having another first receiver option. I think he did spill the ball once or twice, and I think he's going to get like absolutely brutalized for it. But realistically, how nervous are you going to be? He had like two or three caps like a few years ago and then was just shunned from the squad. And I think in general, he did pretty well. Although I wouldn't admit Freddie Stewart for him. I'd have them both in the squad.
Okay, elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to bring this up. So right, there's a lot of talk about this being like a New England, right? A New England team, right? The starting squad had an average age of nearly 29 and an average of 50 caps. It's not exactly a New England, right? But, and I think some of these players are just being held on to for too long, right? Like Elliot Daly was quality, but I've not seen him do much his Six Nations to make me think, wow, he's our winger. And Henry Slade like was in and out of the squad, didn't go to the World Cup. He's come back, but like he's not a long term answer. I'm thinking get someone fast in for Elliot Daly. Move Tommy Freeman to 13, where Northampton are trying to play him, and then get Freddie Stewart on the other wing.
Oh, so you will still have Fairbank at the fullback and Freddie Stewart on the wing?
Yeah, I'm thinking that's the way forward.
Okay. I don't know how I feel like that, because I do think, like, in my mind, Freddie Stewart, he's a great 15. Like, I would probably put him top 3-4 in the world at the moment. So, yeah. I don't know. So who did you like what you saw from Faye Wabosa? Like, would you put him as that replacement?
Yeah, and I think I'd put him in at 11, because he's like rapid. When he came on, like he had something in his running. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of one-off running and not exciting lines, and then he comes in, cuts that line for the try, and it's like, oh, like he's got a bit of X factor. So get him on at 11, and then 14 is basically a second fullback anyway in general, right? Like when you look at most teams in the world. So why not put Freddie Stewart there?
What about switching them around and having Fairbank on the wing and having Freddie Stewart at fullback?
Yeah, I guess so. I think the only reason I've got it that way in my head is at Leicester, Borthwick used to have like Burns play 15 quite a bit with Stewart on the wing.
Okay.
So it's kind of something he's done before, something he used, tactic he's used to. Realistically, I can imagine it's pretty interchangeable. But yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's interesting. So I think the counter to that is obviously, if you remove Elliot Daly, you remove Henry Slade, then you've got quite an inexperienced, inexperienced back line. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure, their wisdom, plays a massive part in the development of the young guns and be able to, make the correct decisions come crunch time. So, for example, if we have Finn Smith, taking over the starting 10 or Marcus Smith, are you comfortable enough in that young back line to be able to go up against the more experienced, the All Blacks, Ireland, South Africa? Do you know what I mean?
I think realistically, like, we're not going to beat those teams with who we're playing anyway, right? So why not get some young people in, ring of fire, see how it goes? And it's not like Marcus Smith hasn't played against these teams, played tons of games. Like, he's got a fair few caps. He's played tons of quins in Europe and everything. Freddie Stewart has had so many caps in the backfield. Like, I don't think it's actually as inexperienced as it might seem.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm no rugby coach, but that's what I'd do.
Yeah. I think with England and the English fans, I think they've been, like I said, they've been promised so much, in terms of their future and their development, having such a promising finish at the World Cup. And they're, they were supposed to be cagey at the beginning. And, this is the second, it's the second go around for Steve Borthwick now. So they're expecting, yes, winning is important, but they also want to enjoy, watching their team play. So I think they do need to start, changing things around. They need to develop.
Yeah, that's it. And And there's potential there for sure. Like, you see the players play for their clubs, so give them a crack. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we playing Danny Kerr, who's 37, and George Ford, who's got 93 caps at 9-10, when neither of them are going to make the next World Cup?
Yeah, I know. And I think what's also really interesting to not talk about is how does Farrell, you know, kind of fit into this picture? Like, do you feel like his omission is, like, really impactful? Like, he's, like, we're always talking about Dupont, you know, leaving and going away from France. But we're not talking about Farrell. You know, obviously, he took a leave of absence. So, what do you think? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I think it must be massive. Like, he is, everything you hear about him from, like, any team he's played, he's such a leader. But I also think it's not just him. It's like Laws as well, the other person who's been captain of England the last year, and Tom Curry. I think those three players were like the last three captains of England.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those three, that there's a lot of leadership that's missing.
Okay.
But at the same time, like, look at Wales. Like, they've got no leadership and they seem to be growing. Like, they haven't actually got there yet, but...
Yeah,
but like you feel like they're making moves. They're gonna get somewhere. They're learning. Yeah, why not?
I wasn't particularly impressed with George Ford, and his performance. Nor Danny Kerr's. I thought Danny Kerr was really poor, actually. And yeah, I think if I was to have one person in the team that was older, I would have Farrell. And I just think he just steadies the ship. But then again, you know, do you have him at 10? Do you have him at 12? Because if you have him at 12, then you can't have Lawrence and Freeman. So there's a whole dynamic there, but we don't need to go into that.
Yeah, we'll just wait till he's Lions captain next year.
I mean, there's writing on the wall. Farrell head coach, Farrell being the captain. I mean, yeah, it wouldn't be too surprising.
No, no way. Too much nepotism. We can't allow it.
That's an Englishman saying that you can't have that. So
he can be in the team, but he can't be captain.
You kind of mentioned it. You know, Wales—they haven't managed to get the win yet. They are growing. They're heading the direction.
Mm.
Let's break down that final game of the weekend.
Yeah, I thought in the first half Wales actually weren't that impressive. It's almost as if they. Yeah, I don't know. They were a bit intimidated by Ireland.
Yeah.
And I think, like, they were quite lucky to go into, like, change rooms at halftime with, like, the, I think it was 17-0 at the, I think, 17-3. Ireland had 17. And I think it could have been more. But I think in the second half they came out and they actually played a bit of rugby, gave it more of a crack, but I think the Irish bench was just stronger. Like, I think the replacements in the end kind of ensured that nothing was going on. But yeah, I think it was good progress. How about you? What do you think?
I agree. I think what I've been seeing on Twitter from particular Welsh fans is, even though they're losing, I think the growth that they're seeing, like, Gatland's going to be very, very happy with the performance. I don't think the final scoreline reflected the whole performance. I think Wales kind of let in, I think it was like two soft tries, you know, in the last quarter of the game, which then just, you know, extended the scoreline. But I think there was like, it was pretty much that, I think it was like 17-7, and Wales were like looking like they were going to score. And I think if they, and then it was all like a sudden turnaround, and then Ireland like ran away with it, and you know, then it was 24-7. So I think in that moment, like, Wales had a firm grip on the game, but and if they scored next, and then it's only a 3-point game if they get the conversion, and I think that changes the entire dynamic of the last quarter of that game. So yeah, and again, I think with the Welsh side as well, they're rebuilding, they're changing the dynamics, you know, they're changing like the props, and you know, they have still got injuries, and they're trying to, you know, mess around with a 10. And, like, I think Costello had a much better performance this time around. I think there's a lot of positives to take away from the Welsh team.
Yeah, 100%. I'd be pretty happy as a Welsh fan, even though they've lost three on the bounce.
Well, which is really weird, because we've always talked about how important it is to be winning to kind of win over the fans.
I think because of how young they are, there's a little bit of grace period.
Okay.
I think because they literally have pretty much no experienced players.
I mean, George North, Nick Tompkins.
So they have got some, but I don't think they've got enough. Like, especially in like key positions, like the back row, which is pretty much the most important or the most impactful players on the pitch. Like, Tommy Rafael's not played tons of games for Wales. I didn't even know him before the Six Nations. I'm going to be honest. And then Wainwright's been in and out a bit, but it's not like he's got tons of caps to his name. So I don't know. I think they get away with it because of that. But I think come next year, they'll have to get some wins on the board, or it won't be looking too happy.
So are you writing them off for the rest of the championship? Is that them done?
I'm not writing them off. I'm not going to write them off. I think, you know, France, that's an easy game for them to win. Against Italy, it might be more of a struggle, but...
it's crazy how that sentence is actually probably true.
But yeah, I'm actually reckon that Wales-Italy game could be one of the most entertaining games.
Yeah, I hope so. Is it the round five fixture or is it the last weekend? Do you know?
So they got final weekend, Wales-Italy.
What a way to go out.
Yeah. To be fair, that final weekend, Wales-Italy, England-France, Scotland-Ireland.
Ireland.
It's a pretty exciting end.
That is...
Obviously, watch the next games too, but that's an exciting way to finish.
Yeah. Don't just not watch round five. I think Wales, they're heading in the right direction. They just need to... I think they need one win at least from the next two. I think that kind of steadies the ship a little bit more. And then obviously it's just been announced that they're playing South Africa, you know, in Twickenham in the end of June as well, which is another huge test.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, I'm excited to see where this Welsh team, how they progress.
Yeah. So who is their win going to be against? You've got France, you've got Italy. You're saying they need one. Who do you reckon they're gunning for?
I mean, both, technically. But I think they'll probably be eyeing up Italy more so than France. I think, France have somehow managed to avoid two losses. Whether their luck runs out, at some point, I would suspect that it does. But I think they would probably be eyeing up Italy, more so than the French team. What do you think?
I think logically you would eye up Italy. Like, jokes aside, I think that is who you should eye up. But I actually think the way the Welsh are trying to play, like, the French have some big boys and moving them around the pitch. They had like tons of ball in play time last week. They try and play fast tempo. I can see that getting the French.
Okay.
More likely than Italy, who have played high tempo. I think if you want to surprise someone with your game plan, like, France is probably the team to do it.
Yeah, I would prefer that way. I would prefer that they beat France. It'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next two rounds. But to kind of round it out, what did you think of Ireland? I don't think there's too much to talk about.
Yeah, I feel like there's not a lot to talk about because they are just kind of steamrolling their way through.
They're just winning.
Oh, they're just winning. And they've really shown that the quarterfinal curse is a thing, because every other time they play, ridiculous.
Yeah. I agree. I just, they are just, like I said, there's not been much change in the squad. They've been very fortunate, not many injuries. So they've just been able to carry on from where they left off. and they're just very cohesive. It's not, there's no stress when they play. It's all calm, and everybody knows their role. Everybody knows the system. So there's just no surprises at the moment. Nobody is throwing a spanner in the work.
Yeah.
Everything's going towards our script.
Yeah. I've not seen them, I think all tournament, even hit like fifth gear or like top gear, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. But like, I thought against Wales, they didn't even really come out third. Do you know what I mean? They looked pretty cohesive. Like Wales kind of got into the game, but I was never worried for Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was just like, oh, they'll just start playing harder and score more tries. This
is the thing. Like, they're not putting in maximum effort, but they're coming out with a bonus point win. Yeah. So, like, from a coaching point of view and a management point of view, you're just like, oh, job done. Like, they don't need to have massive point differentials because they've got 15 points from a possible 15 points. So it's like, there's not much more you could be asking.
Yeah, what a buffer. But it does mean, you know, not all our Irish player listeners, like, the pressure is all on you. Like, I would be scared. You know, coming up, you've got two big games. You got Scotland, who would probably more likely do something than England, but that would make it even more embarrassing if you lost to England. Like, it's coming soon, and I'm just saying.
Nah, I don't... I mean, there is the pressure. They should perform now. And if they don't, then social media will have them for dinner. Because, it'll be another choke. But, yeah, we'll see how we go.
They do love a choke, but I don't think they're going to this time. I think they've got it.
Yeah, I think, they were, like I said, they need to be caught off guard by something special to really put them on the back foot. And I'm not sure Scotland or England has it in them to do that at the moment. But I'll be happy to prove them wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say anything, but it is strange how, as soon as they put a Munster player at 10, no choking. Like, I'm just saying, there's something in that.
Wow, you really don't like Leinster. Right, okay, so I think we've kind of wrapped up there. I think the final thing that we should end on is the new idea, the new head-to-head Ben v. Michael in the boxing ring. We've decided we're going to create a new debating segment where one of us will take the pro, one of us will take the against, and we'll let the listeners decide as to whose argument was better and what they think.
Yeah, so, exactly.
This week's topic is going to be about rolling subs.
Yeah, because I never realised, literally until a couple of days ago, the top 14 has rolling subs.
How good. I didn't know that either until you texted me. So
yeah.
I can't believe it. So I'm going to take the four, but I'll be gracious. I'll let you to go first. And why do you think it's a bad idea? And then I'll go.
Yeah, I think... To be fair, I wasn't actually that surprised that the top 14 has it when you see how big the French players are, right? Like, you see how much they are, like, how monsters, like Winnie Antonio, like Posolo Tuolangi, like, you're like, oh, actually, it kind of checks out. But I think having rolling subs, giving the big players time to come off, have a breather, come back on, I think it kind of doesn't do well for the space. And it turns it into more of a power game, which... Like, obviously, it's exciting. Like, we love big hits. We love, like, strong runs. But I think I quite love it when you get some fancy footwork. You've got a nice little winger dancing down, making a prop look like a mug. And I just think it doesn't bring that conducive element. And that's where I'm going to start.
Okay. I mean, I disagree, obviously. But I think you could still, like, you're still going to have the fancy footwork and, you know, even with fresher players, like, I don't think you need to be tired for that flair element of the game to be within the sport. And I think the argument for having rolling subs is actually, you know, you are bringing fresh bodies on and you are allowing those key players to have, it's mostly going to be the forwards, if we're being honest, to be fresh. And it actually, I think, increases the safety of the sport. And I think it actually is really good for player welfare. The main argument for the bomb squad when South Africa was bringing seven forwards on is that they were really fresh, changing their whole scrum and going against a very weakened other forward pack, and their safety was then, you know, damaged. Whereas if you have rolling subs and you allow the players to be rested and to catch their breath back, then they'll be able to compete for longer and they're not going to be as many silly mistakes in contact.
Ah, oh, so I disagree with your safety element. I didn't think this was going to, yeah.
Oh.
So I think by having more rest allows, as I'm saying, like the players to be bigger, to be heavier, which means the collisions are also bigger, more impactful, and like likely have more toll on someone's body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it actually makes it more dangerous because you're having bigger collisions. Like you see how important like head safety is in the game. Having someone like 120 kilos run at you versus someone 150 kilos, which some of these French boys are, like that has such a big difference. And I think by having rolling subs, you're almost enabling more players to be like that because they don't have to run for the whole game. Like you could replace your whole pack.
Yeah. I think, sorry to cut you off. I don't know how it works in the top 14. Like if it's like all the entire seven on the bench, or sorry, the whole eight on the bench allowed to, you know, constantly roll. But I think I understand your point, but I think the collisions are just one aspect of the game. If they're too heavy and they aren't moving around the park, then they will be exposed by the backs anyway. I don't think it's just going to be like the focus around the collisions is just one area of the game. I think across the entire match, I think it would probably be even out. And I don't think there would be as many players putting on, I don't think there would be putting on like 5-10 extra kilos and then try and, you know, cut their playing time down by 30 minutes. I don't see that happening because you'd also want to make sure that there's no dip in the level of your team. There would, you know, you've got to make sure that you're maintaining a certain standard.
So I actually think that you can see that already in the French team by how big they are. When you see in European matchups, the French scrums or the French team scrums generally tend to be heavier. So I think you're actually seeing, because they have in their league these interchanges, and they get 12 interchanges and they have the normal size bench.
Okay.
Like, I think you are actually seeing bigger players because of that already.
But then look at how the French are doing right now. They're not doing very well. So it's not actually aiding, you know, their actual success.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean it's not happening.
Yeah. But then sure, but it, you know, in that element, you're kind of saying that, you know, it would be probably beneficial to have heavier guys, and then you're winning collisions more easily, and then you're rolling on more people. But it's, you know, I think teams will be able to work around it.
Yeah, I think. With the game, like so much of law changes at the minute are about creating space. Like when you look at the 50-22, the idea of that wasn't so you can put a kick in and move up the pitch. It was so teams would have to have less people in the front defensive line, more coverage of the backfield to create space. Yeah. So like if there's no space anyway, like it's hard for that running rugby to flow. So surely fatigue and tired legs would actually enable that more rather than, oh, they look tired, let's bring them off for 20 and then we'll bring them back on, like, because they're a key player. In general, I'm actually more for less subs than what we have anyway, but that's a topic for a later date. Yeah.
I mean, I think it is a very different sport. The NRL is obviously a very good example of doing this. And NFL, as well. You know, they're rolling subs, and I think that just shows that the framework does work, and it allows your team to be the best it can be across the 80 minutes. So you are going to have a higher level of spectacle for the fans to enjoy. And I also think we are already doing this in the sport without even knowing it, because how many times have we seen a replacement prop come on injured, and then gets injured, and then the starting prop have to come on again? So I do think that we are actually doing this already without knowing it, but we just haven't really, you know, made it a proper thing. I think players are actually having a bit of a rest, you know, unintentionally, because it's, you know, from a result of an injury. But, you know, and we kind of see that they don't have like a massive impact on the game, you know, because they, you know, they might have played 60 minutes already, and then they've got to come on with a 5-minute break, and then they're back on again. So I don't think it's going to be as impactful as we already think. So why not do it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any more reasons to what I said, so this is actually at the end of our...
This is why we can, you know, let the listeners see what they think. And, you know, they can choose a side. They can choose either mine or yours.
Yeah. So yeah, for everyone listening, we'll put a little poll on Spotify, so you can either pick me or you can be wrong. It's up to you.
See, Ben's just a joker, so why would you... I've presented out the facts. You know, Ben's just looking for the comedic effect.
Yeah, so... I bring the vibes, though. Like less sub, better vibes. That's all I'm saying. You put that in your head together.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And I don't know whether... You know, I don't know how long the top 14 have done it. I don't know if it will come into first grade. But I think it's a really good topic.
Yeah, I agree. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Yeah.
But yeah, let us know what you think. We hope you enjoyed this episode, you know, of another Six Nations Roundup. Keep an eye on our social media for our clips. And thank you for all the support you've already given on the other post that we've put out. And we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, and on that, because he's being modest, like if anyone wants to see how good a life Mike has and how he just loves going and supporting anyone but England, like go watch his little clip, because it is actually quality, and fair play to him.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Appreciate that. Okay, see you guys later.